Imagine eating freeze-dried food for months and months on end.
It's the texture that you get bored of, and you don't have that crunch or that juice that you miss with food.
Food is a fuel for everyone. But for some endurance athletes, spending weeks or months on the move for each event, the word takes on a completely new meaning.
It's not like, oh, yummy, what's for dinner tonight? It's like, I just need fuel to keep going.
And while the taste and texture is something to come to terms with, so is the art of cooking while you race. How do you prepare food while you're sailing around the world on your own while this is going on?
You want to know what it's like sailing upwind in 30 knots? I'm going to show you.
I'm Tamsin Ford, and this week on The Food Chain from the BBC World Service, we discover what food these athletes choose to take with them and how they cook it. How do you squeeze in food when you spend days on your feet scrambling over mountains?
Actually eating and running is impossible. That sort of impact in the stomach is a little bit like a tumble dryer.
If eating and running don't work, what about eating and swimming across entire oceans?
So what's happening, Henry?
The seals.
Yeah, the seals swimming with Ben.
Yeah. There.
It's following.
Oh, just here. Whoa!
How does putting your body to its absolute limit physically, day after day, change your desire for food?
On the beach, a big fruit salad, so fresh pineapple and all those fruits. It was like a party in your mouth.
In this episode, we've brought together three athletes to talk about the planning, the practicalities, the monotony, and whether for them, food is simply a fuel to help them cross the finish line, or does it play a more psychological role?
My name is Dee Kafari and I'm a round-the-world sailor. So I've circumnavigated the globe 6 times now.
Mine's a bit underwhelming in comparison, but I'm Billy White. I'm a chef based in Stockholm, Sweden, and I also have run various ultramarathons, and next week I'm going to become an ultra cyclist for the first time.
My name is Ben Leconte. I'm a marathon swimmer and ocean advocate.
Dee, let's start with you. I want to talk about the food planning involved in your races. How do you even go about planning for a 6-month race? I mean, I can't really even get my head around this week, let alone the next 6 months.
I'm exactly the same when it comes to shopping on a weekly basis, and I end up having to run to the shops quite regularly for all the things that I've forgotten during the week or that have run out. So you need a lot of help. You need a little bit of planning, especially when you consider that the environment I'm in, weight is critical. You spend fortunes on changing fastenings to titanium so that they're just as strong but super lightweight. So the last thing you want to do is load your boat up with extra weight that you don't need. There's also no refrigeration, and the only cooking facilities we have is the ability to boil water in a jet boil. So we're very limited. Fresh food pretty much only lasts for the first 10 days. And then after that, you have really got to explore the realms of freeze-dried food. And I have to say that technology and development has come on in leaps and bounds, and the repertoire is actually quite vast and varied. But it's the texture that you get bored of, and everything after a period of time takes on the same texture, and you don't have that crunch or that juice that you miss with food. And you always crave the things that you can't have.
When you say freeze-dried food, what are we talking about?
In essence, it is taking a spaghetti bolognese, for example, and just extracting the water from it so that it is a dry format in a bag.
So like space food?
Like space food. Everyone says, is it like space food? Yeah. Exactly like space food that you can imagine. And you boil water, you add it, you stir it round, leave it for 10 minutes, and then hey presto, spaghetti bolognese, which is probably making Billy absolutely cringe as a chef, but it does go a long way to explaining my culinary skills in the kitchen when I've eaten freeze-dried food for as long as I have. Yes, my cooking skills are not that great.
Billy, Dee was just saying, does that food make you cringe as a chef?
I mean, given the first choice as an option, I would choose to not eat freeze-dried food, I have to say. But I think it's not too bad. And in the case of, I've eaten freeze-dried food if I'm going out for several days running and I don't want to carry too much weight in my pack. It's easy and it's simple to prepare and it. And after a long day on your feet, it's quite delicious in a way. So it's definitely not as horrific as it sounds. It can be good, but I can imagine 6 months of eating freeze-dried food would be a different matter altogether.
Well, that's it. So for your trail runs, some can be as long as around 30 hours. Is that right? So we're not talking months like Dee, but the difference is you've got to carry everything on your back. So how do you prepare for that?
I think there is an element of what do I know is good that works for me from an high energy, like I can carry nuts and a few bars, maybe a chocolate bar here or there if I know I need a treat, or I don't know, cold pizza can be quite delicious, even though it sounds kind of gross if it's been in a rucksack for a few hours. But then on a longer effort, going multiple days, then maybe there's a little bit of a treat here or there. I really like porridge in the morning. So then cooking a single portion of porridge is quite nice. Maybe one thing was really good one time, taking out just a bag of cherry tomatoes. And after 10 hours of, you eat a lot of sweet things, a lot of things with high calorie density, and just having a few cherry tomatoes, like, freshened everything up, gave a real energy boost, even though it was something as simple as just that.
Just having a different taste in your mouth, I imagine, is quite nice.
I think so. It's so much sweet things, and often with like these sort of, I guess, shorter endurance events, even though they are up to a couple of days long, you pack in so many calories in a short period of time, and often sweet things is a really good way to get in a lot of calories, but it gets a little bit monotonous from a taste perspective.
Ben, like Dee, some of your swims are also months long. So what are the main things you think about when you're planning your food for the trip?
Yeah, so unlike Dee, I don't have to worry about the weight because, you know, the speed of the boat doesn't matter because I'm very slow swimming. So the boat has to follow. And then I have a main support boat. So we have a lot of space. The longest expedition we had was 6 months, and we had close to a ton of food on the
wow.
on the boat. So we are freeze dried, but also we had a lot of canned foods. And for me, it is a little bit different because after swimming, you know, about 8 hours a day, it doesn't matter what the taste of the food really. I'm just hungry and I eat about anything. Now, I need to make sure that the food is going to go through my system easily and I don't have a problem digesting. But other than that, the taste, you know, I can eat about the same thing for a while before getting very bored of it.
Has your planning changed over the years? Do you now pack different things than at the start of doing this?
Oh, absolutely. At the beginning, it was kind of a trial and error, you know. When I was trying different type of food and what worked best for me, I found out that, unfortunately, I was feeding the fish more than me, you know. So everything went back out and the fish were happy. So the good thing is that I have fish coming around and swimming with me while I was trying to different type of food. And until I found out that I need something very natural and liquid based while I swim. And then after, I wasn't feeding the fish anymore. And also the difficulty in my case is that during the day I'm in the water swimming, all I have, it's a soup. When I swim, I have a small dinghy that follows me with two crew member. And every hour they will pass me a thermos bottle with soup in it. And also I get all the liquid that I need. So I don't need to be drinking at the same time. So the big meals and the big calorie consumption comes when I am back on the boat in the evening. At night, I wake up because I'm hungry. And then in the morning, I start with a big breakfast. But it has to be something as natural as possible because my body doesn't take those power bars and all those things.
That's what I wanted to ask, actually. One of the first things I think about as an endurance swimmer is the practicality of eating. Like, when do you eat and how do you eat? And I always thought, or my mum always told me, you know, don't eat before you go swimming. Well, how does that apply to you?
Yeah, unfortunately, I cannot do that. You know, I don't have enough hours in the day to wait. And I was followed and helped by many different doctors and nutritionists. And the best advice I ever had is that one of them told me, just follow your body and don't try to force a schedule onto your body. Just listen to your body. And exactly what I had to do. So like I mentioned earlier, if in the middle of the night I woke up because I was hungry, I was never trying to fight it and to go back to sleep. And I was going, you know, get a big meal and eat it and go back to sleep.
Dee, what's the biggest challenge for you eating on the boat?
Sometimes the weather doesn't always play ball. You can be in some pretty tough conditions, especially in the depths of the Southern Ocean. And the last thing you want to do is get a food packet out and boil some water and then pour it in, or you're so hungry that you don't wait the full 10 minutes. I've done that a couple of times. And if you don't wait for the food to hydrate properly, you end up with really bad stomach ache. And sometimes conditions are so bad, or you've got to go and do something and you're just trying to wolf down the fuel. It's not like, oh, yummy, what's for dinner tonight? It's like, I just need fuel to keep going. I go through the time zones as well. So sometimes you get to the point where you don't know whether you're having dinner or breakfast and you get a little bit confused what meal you should be eating. But I think it's the monotony of the same routine and the same kind of stuff. So I learned quite early on, much like Benoit said, everybody has to listen to their own body. And I learned that if I had a 7-day food bag, I naturally fell into the routine of Monday it would be this meal, Tuesday would be that meal. And that's really demoralizing over a long period of time. So what I do is I have a 10-day food bag and I can eat anything I like from that 10-day bag, but I can't move on to the next bag until day 11. And that stops me eating all my favorite stuff first and just leaving me with the stuff that I'm not so keen on later on. It helps me keep a variety in place and it just keeps my interest a little more. Although you're thinking about performance and your sailing and the weather and all the damage and all the problems that you may have, food has such a big impact on your morale and how you feel and your well-being, and it helps you be able to perform. So it's really important, and we often underestimate just how important it ends up being.
Billy, running is virtually impossible to eat on the go. How do you do it?
Actually, eating and running is impossible. That sort of impact in the stomach is a little bit like a tumble dryer. It's not a great digestion sort of environment. So I tend to hike when I'm going to eat rather than trying to sit down and have like a nice rest. Getting back up is always difficult.
I've done a few triathlons, nothing like any of you, but I've tried the gel packs. And for listeners who don't know what they are, they're basically pouches of high calorie gloop, aren't they? And I really couldn't get on with them. Would you use something like that?
I do, just out of ease. I don't think they're very nice, but when you need to eat something every 30 minutes for 30 hours, just to be able to take a mouthful of this gloop and wash it down with a gulp of water, and you know you're good. Because I think that's often the thing, is the monotony of eating. Your legs are hurt if you're going uphill and climbing, or going downhill, or hours and hours on the feet. But just having to keep on eating and remembering that you need to keep on eating. When you're feeling good, you forget to eat because it feels good. And when you're feeling bad, you're so miserable and feeling sorry for yourself that you forget to eat. So you need this sort of regular. And sometimes the gels, I know that if I have one gel an hour and then something that I like between, then I've got the horribleness is done with the gels. Then I can have something that I might look forward to a little bit.
You mentioned the word monotony then, and I think all three of you have spoken about that. But Ben, for you, is food simply just a fuel, or do you get any enjoyment out of it during the race?
Well, you know, for me, I look at it more just as a fuel. Especially that I have to be very particular in what I eat, because I am most of the time laying. And when you lay, it's much more difficult to, you know, digest the food and have it go through. So I stick to what I know works for me and don't try to disturb that and have problem with your gut. And it's the awful feeling to be in the water trying to swim with the waves going up and down and, you know, having that some type of nausea or the food coming back. You don't want to be in that situation. So I know that I get little enjoyment.
Billy, as a chef and an endurance athlete, that must be quite hard to sort of, you know, mix the two when eating and food preparation for you is an art. It is about taste. It's about the freshness. Whereas as an endurance athlete, does that just all go out the window?
I don't think it completely goes out of the window, but it goes sort of on pause for a period, I think. There's elements of racing where there can be food that's delicious and something that really picks you up as a sort of a morale boost when you're feeling a little bit low. And that's really important. But there is a lot of monotony of the road and monotony of the taste. But it is, I think, I can only imagine how it would be to go for months on end. Well, I couldn't do it. I think to go a couple of days and then come home and have something delicious to eat and a couple of drinks, that's more than enough for me.
And when you say you couldn't do it, is that because of the food element rather than the physical element?
I think it's something to do with it. Next week I'm starting the length of Sweden, a bicycle race. So it goes from the north to the south. It's about 2,000 kilometres. So that will be the longest thing I've ever done. I think it will take around 7 to 8 days. I'm not entirely sure. And that one, I'm nervous about how it will be food-wise. I know that there's one restaurant that I'd quite like to eat on at the roundabout the halfway point. So I'm hoping that coincides with
a daytime rather than a nighttime.
Exactly. So I think to go more than a week without eating something delicious would be a challenge. I think the biking will also be a challenge, but it's definitely, I need short treats more regularly than that, I think.
Well, that's it. So everything that all three of you do is such an incredible physical challenge and a mental challenge in connection with that. For you, Dee, you're at sea for months on end and sometimes on your own. Is it important to have that little something to look forward to when it comes to food?
I think food has a major impact on your well-being, that little morale boost when you need it. I'm quite a reward-driven person, so I have to feel that sense of achievement. And if you've got a little treat that picks you up, you know, even if it's just not really that nutritious for you, but it makes you feel better sometimes, then it's worth having. When you're dealing with your mental resilience over such a long period of time, you have to do what works for you a little bit. So you can sometimes throw the rule book out the window of being really strict with what you eat and how efficient it is for your body, and sometimes just do what makes you feel good.
So then what is your treat?
Oh, I'm quite naughty, actually, but I'm a bit of a sucker for
gin and tonic.
Oh, God, that would be nice. No, that's definitely after a couple of days after I've got back, then maybe yes. I can have one of those. But I like chewy sweets. So Haribo sweets is an example, but something that's naughty but nice. And you can get those little tiny packs that have got like 10 little sweets in. Because I don't have much willpower. So if a packet was open, I'd eat the whole lot, which is why I do the really mini packs. And that's my little treat if things are going well.
Ben, you must swallow a lot of salt water during these challenges. And anyone who's swam in the sea, it affects how you taste and the inside of your mouth. How do you cope with that?
Yeah, that's kind of strange because, you know, to have that very heavy, salty taste in your mouth for so many hours and after so many days, it becomes something disgusting for me to have a little bit of salt water seeping through my snorkel, for example. So I don't like to have that. But what is funny is that right after swimming, very often I will jump into a bag of chips. So yeah, even though the salty taste of the mouth from the ocean disgusts me throughout the day, but the first thing I'm going to go after is a salty chip, salty food.
What's the strangest craving you've ever had during a race?
I don't think I've craved anything and say, oh, I need to have it, I need to have that, other than having fresh fruits, you know, like biting in a piece of like an apple or a strawberry. When I did the swim, I stayed out for 6 months. One of the person brought me on the beach, a big fruit salad. It was in Hawaii, so fresh pineapple and all those fruits. And I started eating like I had never eaten those before. It was an amazing feeling, you know. It was like a party in your mouth. And Billy can refer to that, how the food explodes sometime in your mouth and you have all these aromas that go through all your body and you are in a different zone. You know?
It's funny because you really talked earlier about how food is a fuel for you, but the way you describe that, clearly food is much more than just fuel for you.
Yeah, but during the expedition and the swim, I know how to focus on things that I can control. I'm not going to worry about things that I cannot control. So food is one of the things that we don't have, the fresh food. So it's okay. I use it as just a source of energy, and that's what it is. But then after, when I'm able to get a hold of the food that I miss, yeah, that's a different ballgame.
Billy, do you have a guilty pleasure when it comes to food during a race?
It's often quite practical things. So it's nuts and it's bars. I make bars, which is really kind of simple, and ones that work for me rather than the shop bought ones, and I know exactly what's in them. So I don't, during races, not so much. I did once run a race and it was going terribly. I took a fall and I ended up having to walk for maybe 50 miles. At the food station, they had hot dogs and light beer. So that was definitely as the race was going badly and I didn't really need to think about running, as I was just sort of hiking it in to finish, I did really enjoy a couple of beers and a hot dog during after about 80 miles in. So that was a great treat.
Dee, have you ever had a craving that you've just had to try and get out of your mind because you know you've got 3 or 4 months left?
I think when you're on your own, you can control your inner dialogue. You can control the narrative a lot easier. And yes, you miss things, but I'm very similar to, as Ben said, you know, the crunch of an apple or the juice of an orange that you think, oh, that would be nice. But when you're with a crew, the conversation turns to food really quickly. Oh, and that's always a worry. And everyone talks about burgers or pizzas or, you know, that kind of big indulgence when they get in. And when we get in, you generally get given this food and we all kind of tuck into it, but our eyes are lying to the rest of our body and we start, and actually we can't really digest it properly. It's probably the worst thing we could do. So it takes a few days to adjust.
Do you think these long trips have given you more of an appreciation of food somehow, Dee?
Oh, for me, absolutely. To be able to cook and have different textures and different flavours and have fresh. Everything for me is about being fresh. You know, I'm quite pleased to say at home we don't really eat any processed food. The rule is if we haven't made it, we're not eating it. I've taken that to the extreme just because I live in such a strange environment offshore where everything's packed, everything's predetermined, and there's no facility for any fresh food. I mean, it does make me want to get better in the kitchen, and especially during the last 18 months where we've all been living a slightly different life. It's given me the time and the space to try different things and have the courage to try things. And it's not been too bad. So, Billy, you'll be proud of me with my efforts in the kitchen.
Well, turning to you then, Billy, do you think being an endurance athlete has changed you as a chef in any way?
The lifestyle that comes with it is definitely we eat better as a family. And like Dee says, we eat way less processed food. We cook everything from scratch. I would say I'm a little bit more of a food snob than I was previously. I would, even though I've been a chef for 25 years and I've only been running for 10, I eat definitely better now. But yeah, it's definitely changed me as a cook in a positive, I think.
Becoming endurance athletes has changed each of our guests' relationship with food. There's a recognition that food is a fuel to help them finish their events, while at the same time, an understanding of its psychological importance. But for our ocean adventurers, it's what they have seen that has had the greatest impact. In 2019, Ben swam for more than 2 months through the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, the biggest area of ocean plastic in the world.
while I was swimming, so I had a team members that were there to collect data on plastic and microfibers and so on. And we were towing net, and then at the end of the tour, you count the number of microplastic that you have. So there is one day where we collected the most amount of microplastic, which was over 3,000 pieces. But the same day, it was when I had the amazing encounter of swimming with a sperm whale. And so it made me think that you have those huge animals that filter so much water, and they ingest all those microfibers and microplastic in them. The plastic is the problem, but what is even worse is that we know that the plastic is going to be stored in the meat of the fish, and it goes up the food chain. At the end of the food chain, we, human, eat that. So we eat the fish, we say, oh, it tastes good, but we don't know exactly how much pollutant there is in it. So for that reason, when people ask me, oh, should I eat fish and all that, I like fish, I always tell them, well, try to eat the smallest fish, the one that is at the bottom of the food chain. They have less chance to be contaminated, right? So, yeah, I try to stay away from fish for that reason, seeing the amount of microplastic that goes into their guts.
Dee, you must have seen your fair share of this as well, traveling around the world.
Indeed. And my last round the world, I led the team Turn the Tide on Plastic, and we did in-depth survey into the microplastic content, which hadn't been done before with subsurface water intake. And we did it every day on our trip around the world. And just to take Ben's story just one chapter further, in the depths of the Southern Ocean, so there's a place called Point Nemo, which is the furthest point from land that you can get, we had microplastics present, which just doesn't make sense because there isn't anyone down there. The closest person to you is in the International Space Station, just to give you a relative scenario. And it's just the macroplastics that we see, like the crates, the netting, the food packaging, the bottles, the helium balloons, all this stuff that we see just breaking down with UV degradation and wave action and then being carried on the ocean currents. And when you realise that microplastics are then present in the Southern Ocean, you realise just how big the problem is.
That's all for this week. Thanks to my guests, Benoît Lecomte, Dee Kafari and Billy White. Do let us know what you think about the show. You can email thefoodchain@bbc.co.uk or get in touch with me on Twitter @Tamasin_Ford. And if you can spare a few minutes more, please do give us a rating or a review wherever you found this podcast. If you're able to, it really does help us spread the word about the show. From me and the rest of the team, Simon Tulett and Sarah Stollarts, thanks for listening and join us again next week.
"30 Animals That Made Us Smarter" is back.
What does deep space and deep water have in common?
With 30 more tales of amazing animals.
An elephant's trunk is a truly marvellous thing.
And the human innovations that were inspired by them.
A robot picking up something as delicate as an egg.
30 Animals That Made Us Smarter from the BBC World Service.
It makes us look at nature in a completely new way.
Search for 30 Animals That Made Us Smarter wherever you get your podcasts.